the same units of measurement in the same manner that you have measured here during that 3 to 4 hour time period?
Absolutely, sir.
And what would that, what would your anagrams then be at that?
It depends on the quality of the cigarette. It depends on the ability of the individual to smoke. That peak can range at that 5 minutes from a low of 20 to 25 nanograms to the very highest sample ever achieved in my laboratory came from Sacramento from a party, an anonymous individual from the Department of Justice who apparently had had a marijuana joint laced with hash oil. That was above 250 nanograms. Such an individual would be dangerous to no one because I doubt that that person was ambulating.
Then you said,
but they all reached that baseline at approximately 3 to 4 hours.
But what you're saying is that it only takes one joint, or let me ask you this, even on one joint, how many puffs on one joint to achieve that?
We've done it by blue marker pen around one joint at a quarter and a half, three quarters of one. I have not personally seen, since sometimes it's my responsibility to draw the blood, being a physician, from the volunteer. I have not seen, and this is strictly anecdotal physician observer, I have not seen anybody high after a few joints, I mean a few puffs, but the individual say they're beginning to feel it, just as, for example, would be the case with aspirin or Demerol. After a quarter of a joint, one will hit a peak if no further cigarette is smoked.
After a quarter, okay. Now,
but it gets into the blood at once.
All right. And these units of measurement that you're talking about are units of measurement of the delta 9 THC within the bloodstream. Is that
yes,
correct?
Yes, sir.
All right.
These are the same units that we measure in the breath, and the same units that we measure in the saliva.
And you're saying they stay in the bloodstream 3 to 4 hours, give or take an hour?
Exactly. And that's in harmony with the length of time it stays in the saliva and in the breath. Although I'd like it clear to your scientific group, particularly, that the amount or the length of time is strictly coincidental, because what is in the saliva or in the breath has not been proved to come from the blood. It comes more likely by just osmosis, as it were, because there is a lot of lipophilic proteins right in our saliva. And the more we salivate, like when we're eating food, the more likely it is that the marijuana burn in the cigarette turns to delta-9 THC.
Doctors, you're probably aware what, of course, in these types of laws, what we're trying to establish is a conclusive presumption that an individual is under the influence.
Of course.
Now, and that, I realize, that's a legal phrase and a legal conclusion, and we're trying to combine legal and medical here. Can you say, then, that any and every individual who might be measured to have the within that 3 to 4 hour time period, the 2 to 8 nanograms per milliliter, that they are impaired, that their ability is impaired such as it would affect their ability to drive a motor vehicle?
You're asking the most crucial question that can be asked, and I just came back from Western Germany, they're asking the same question. They are somewhat less of a democracy, and all they want to find out that there is the active ingredient within the bloodstream. The question perhaps might be reworded, because we all know under the influence of alcohol, and everybody is different at a different time, our performance might be slightly increased rather than decreased. Cocaine is a perfect example of such a horrible drug. All right, the better question would be, at this point in time, does an American citizen have a right to have delta-9 THC on the job or when he or she might endanger somebody else? And the background scientifically to that is that people who have done motor simulating type and aviation simulating type work state that not 95, not 98, but 100% of individuals show some impairment when they have taken marijuana within that period of time. So therefore, I'm not a lawmaker, and I probably will never be elected to anything except being a parent. And the question I would raise simply is, does an American citizen have a right to have active Delta-9 THC in the body fluid at the time that person is responsible for somebody else's or his own welfare?
Okay, I understand that, but you understand also that when we are when we're dealing with the percentage of blood alcohol on the alcohol side, we at least in this country, we wrestle with various percentage levels because we are willing to say, as a matter of public policy, that above a certain blood alcohol level, it's presumed the individual, legally presumed the individual's under the influence. What you're telling me is that you feel comfortable in saying that within a 3 to 4 hour period, if you detect from 2 to 8 nanograms Delta-9 THC, that in 100% of the cases, they will show some impairment.
Yes, sir.
All right. If you had a chance to review the bill that we are discussing before us today, you'll note on page 2 of the bill, the testing that we're dealing with indicates that that we're proposing to establish this level with a showing that the person has taken into that person's body the Delta-9 THC not more than 6 hours before the time alleged. Now, I guess I would just simply ask you from a technical standpoint, is that 6 hour time period or provision in the bill an appropriate one, or should we go down more to your 4 hour time period?
Actually, you are being more scientific with your statements than have I been with mine. We are cutting it extraordinarily narrowly because we want to give everybody the greatest likelihood of being convicted if it's within 4 hours. What has been shown on behavioral studies, 6 hours is correct.
Okay. I think you did allude to this, but I am curious about this in the testing. You feel that from a testing standpoint that the most accurate and simplest test at this point would be to take a saliva sample for the officer.
Yes, sir.
To use a Q-tip, take a saliva sample, put it in a tube. How long can you retain that sample before it starts to break down, or does it start to break down?
That's called worst conditions testing, ladies and gentlemen, and what we have done is place such samples in a closed vehicle for up to 2 weeks in Los Angeles temperature, and then did the tests, and they were just as effectively positive as before and when they were fresh. Remember, in each of the vials is a little organic solid. What happens is a little pipette fault of the material is placed in another tube. And this is what an RIA has done. And the RIA is so routine and so non-research-oriented that it's really not hit, unfortunately, the forensic community until the recent years, and they didn't even understand the terminology RIA. Person who invented it won a Nobel Prize for it, and so widely used medically. Gallo, a lady, if I may be a chauvinist, and Burson, who has since died, this was 1960. And for insulin, it's used in heart-saving circumstances, and the concentrations are mandatory by radioimmune assay. The forensic community have used older-fashioned, more complicated procedures, and less precise, and they talk of interfering substances. A well-done, optimized radioimmune assay can be immensely sensitive and immensely specific. And the reality of what transpires, for those of you who have not heard what it is, there is an optimally labeled, say with iodine, marijuana molecule. There is a certain amount of antibody, very small amount present. If you find the isotope on the antibody fraction in the presence of the sample to be tested, say I had 14,000 counts, that's what your machine counts, blips per second. And if 14,000 counts are on the antibody fraction, which is heavy, that means the sample that is also there is negative. But if all of the counts, say like 7,000, are missing on the antibody fraction, something has prevented it from getting onto the antibody. And that something can only be the positivity of the sample being tested.
Doctor, perhaps to save some time, let me just ask you this. Have you read some articles or have some publications on your testing results? And
yes, sir.
Could you leave with us or perhaps send us?
I'll have to send them.
Send a compendium of those.
I left a briefcase full of legal matter that I needed for Charleston tomorrow morning, but I know it by heart.
I appreciate that.
But I'll see that.
Okay. Thank you. Further questions? Doctor, if you could supply that, we would be grateful. We do appreciate your coming today.
We have a preprint on the saliva, which now sits at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. We intend to extend it just from this point of view, and you gentlemen will have a little laugh at this, to drugs including cocaine and everything else. And I thought of a nice little acronym which everybody shudders, SAP, S-A-P, Saliva Abuse Profile.
Thank you, Doctor. Thank you, Representative Markham.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Representative Farmer.
Have to leave later my speech because a mistake was made, so I will send it immediately this afternoon to you. However, I have enclosed some cuts from newspapers that I have been collecting, only a small part of them, and also on the back of each one of the packets is the amendments that we just had finished this morning, and we didn't have time to send them to you in advance. By the way, I'm Representative Annette Farmer, East Multnomah County. This bill was drafted sometime last summer, and I think once before I talked to your committee and told you that I have been interested in that issue for a very long time, particularly because of what is happening, reading in the papers all of these accidents due to drunk driving and, of course, traveling to other countries, knowing that everybody has much stiffer laws than we do. And so when I did get in touch with Mothers Against Drunk Driving more than a year ago, we started talking about, and so that's how the bill came this last summer. Driving, if you don't mind, I'll read it. Driving under the influence of alcohol is not a new phenomenon, which suddenly has zoomed on the horizon. In 1939, a National Safety Congress was held, and reports indicated that about 30% of drivers injured in accidents had been drinking. What is really new is that the American public has finally become interested in the problem and wants to do something about it. Just last session, we passed a bill establishing the diversion program and increasing the driving under the influence penalties. About 68% of these who enter the diversion program complete the program. Unfortunately, this is not sufficient to deal with the problem of drink driving. One out of two persons will be directly or indirectly victimized by a drunken driver sometime during their lifetime. There are 133 million drivers in the United States and 100 million drinkers. We have over 50,000 deaths a year, 35% involving drivers under 25 years of age. In the last decade, over 250,000 people have lost their lives due to drunk driving. Over 1 million people every year are injured. At least 45% of all accidents are alcohol-related. 4 out of every 10 fatal accidents involve drunk drivers. On Friday and Saturday nights, many cars are driven by drivers too fuzzy to be in control. Alcohol distorts eye focus and affects the ability to judge distances as well as peripheral vision. Alcohol reduces control, judgment, and coordination. Alcohol is absorbed rapidly into the system, but it takes time for it to leave the body and the brain. Coffee does not help. The result is just an awake drunk. Alcohol must be broken down by the liver and oxidized before it leaves the body. It is a combination of water and carbon dioxide. In other words, it has to be divided. Only one of nearly 2,000 drivers under the influence of alcohol is ever arrested. Almost none spends time in jail. As Dr. Proctor of Maryland says, laws are only as good as the enforcement. I like that sentence. Dr. Proctor has been responsible for tougher drunk driving laws in Maryland and other states. Ever since he lost 5 members of his family, 2 sons and 3 grandchildren, he devotes a lot of his time to speaking around the country. His wife also was involved in that accident. She's paralyzed for life, and his 2 daughters were badly injured. The judge for that case found the drunk driver guilty, but sentenced him to just 6 months of suspended jail sentence and 2 days a week to community service, and gave him the right to drive so he could be able to work and support his family. How could that be, people ask? Are we to continue to feel sorry for the drunk and forget the victims? Are we going to continue the slaughter on our streets and highways? We need to change the social attitude, which makes irresponsible behavior seem quite all right. We have all heard the person who brags of drinking many drinks the night before and wonders how he made it home. And people, of course, laugh at that type of jokes. If that person had grabbed a gun after drinking and kill someone, he would have been considered a murderer. But if he kills a child on the road while driving under the influence, the penalty is minimal, and it is called justifiable homicide. Tough drunk driving laws have been passed in California, Colorado, Tennessee, Michigan, Maryland, Washington, Maine, and several other states. In the state of Maine, the law imposed in 1981 calls for 48 hours mandatory sentence in jail, just like my bill does. Initially, there was concern that the law would contribute to overcrowding the already crowded jails, but the director of Maine's Bureau of Safety says that did not prove to be a problem at all. According to him, there were 39% reduction in the number of alcohol-related fatal accidents in the first 11 months of the new law. So when you had that dramatic drop, actually very few people had to go and spend the 48 hours in jail. Besides, I want to add here that because those people are not hardcore criminal. I have never said that it should be necessarily jail. I call it jail. What I mean is detention. And I think those people could be in one of those empty schools, detained, or buildings that we have. The question is to get them out for 2 or 3 days and realize what it means. The federal government is offering grants to states which comply with certain guidelines. I believe my bill, which was drafted last summer, would fit the prerequisites. I propose lowering the permissible amount of alcohol in the blood from 0.10% to 0.08. I would have preferred to be 0.05, like it is in many other countries in Europe, but I know how it is here, so I compromise to make it 0.08. It's the same like in some other states, including the state of Washington, that recently passed their bill. Actually, what the amount is dropping at these 2 points is actually just a half a drink less. In doing this, we would join Utah and California as the strictest states in the country. The information I got did not have the Washington results yet. This would result in the arrest of more persons with BACs between 0.10 and 0.12% as police take the risk of arresting borderline cases. The greatest effect will be to deter social drinkers from drinking and driving. The probability of accidents increases sharply when the driver has 0.08 BAC. I also propose examinations paid to the expense of the person convicted to determine whether the person is a problem drinker or a drunk dependent person. All those convicted of driving under the influence would complete a treatment of information program paid to their own expense. Currently, some drinking drivers may not be examined until they apply for an occupational license or until their second conviction. We must take advantage of the chance to distinguish between social drinkers that need information and problem drinkers that need rehabilitation. Problem drinkers cause a disproportionate share of accidents even when considered against other drinking drivers. An estimated 66% of Oregon's drinking drivers are alcoholics. If treatment is coupled with license suspension, we can effect a reduction in accidents. I also propose a stiffening of the requirement for obtaining an occupational license. Specifically, driving under the influence convicts should have to wait to be eligible to apply for an occupational license. In California and Washington, license suspension was found to be more effective even than jail. Fines or alcohol education and reducing repeat offenders. H. Lawrence Ross, in his book, Deferring the Drunk Driver, has said that license suspension alone may be effective more than anything. It is true that 70 to 80% of suspended drivers drive anyway, but being suspended makes them think and be cautious as they are driving. It is an appropriate penalty. It fits the crime. I propose also mandatory jail sentences for driving under the influence convicts. In this, I am following the recommendation of the Presidential Commission law officials in Oregon. And in Oregon have said that requiring jail time helps deter future offenses. A judge in Multnomah County, a police lieutenant in Washington County are among those that favor jail sentences. Oregon's innovative jail population management dilutes the effect of jail upon offenders. Finally, I propose that fatalities caused while driving under the influence should be specifically designated as second-degree manslaughter. In addition to current prohibitions against plea bargaining, I propose enforcement provisions. It is a terrible thing to let a drunk driver get off easy by pleading guilty to a lesser charge. Currently, those who murder with a car may be driving again within 1 year. Even worse, a drunk driver killer may be on the road just after the accident and may keep driving for months until he or she is finally convicted. We must be fair in our treatment of different forms of murder, and I call it murder. I also support Senate Bill 710 and House Bill 2861. These, I am a co-signer of one of them. These bills would make license suspension immediately. My bill, House Bill 2420, would make certain penalties and programs more certain. The bill can increase the perception of swift and certain punishment that deters the drunk drivers. With a small amendment, this bill will meet the federal incentive grant eligibility requirements. I'm sure you all have the bill, and I have Brad Swank with me. He drafted the bill for me, and we have talked many times, and if you have any questions, because I'm not a lawyer, he could perhaps be able to respond more legally.
Are the questions at this time about the provisions of the bill or the amendments? We may have such questions at the time of work session, Representative Farmer, and perhaps if we might invite you, and if you were available, Mr. Swank, to join us at that time, that's more likely to be the time we're going to be burrowing into particular provisions. Do you have anything you want to add at this point, Brad, or were you here simply to respond?
No. Representative Farmer asked me to come and respond if you had any questions. If there are no questions, I have nothing to add.
All right. Thank you, Representative Farmer.
When are you going to have a work session?
Friday.
Friday. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have three representatives from MAD here in connection with this bill. Would you like the three of you to come up together and... That's Elu Fisk. Dolores Haynes. And then we have, I'm not sure how to pronounce his last name, from Eugene. You need to identify yourselves before you make a statement.
My name is Dolores Clemens. Representative Myers and committee. My name is Dolores Clemens. I'm the president of the Multnomah County chapter of Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, as well as a member of the governor's task force on DUII. I have lived in Oregon for 23 years with my husband, raising a family of three children, and working as a registered pharmacist in this state since 1966. One of those three children, Kathleen, was killed by a drunk driver in 1981. I support all nine House bills being heard today, but due to limited time, will only address House Bill 2420. I chose this bill because it deals with numerous aspects of DUII that are deterrents to drunk driving. The concept of this bill is excellent and should serve as a model for legislation. Several aspects provide sure, swift, and effective penalty that no drunk driver can escape, regardless of personal influence, financial resources, or quality of legal assistance. One aspect that is attractive is that it establishes minimum periods of time when no occupational licenses may be issued. In this room, there are very few people who do not drive a car. I also do not drive a car. Yet I have been employed, raised a family, give speeches, and traveled here today without an occupational license. I have done extensive court monitoring since October of 1981 and see a gross misuse of occupational licenses. I suggest to amend House Bill 2420 to increase the penalty for a driving-related conviction for murder, manslaughter, negligent homicide, or assault. The new penalty would be revocation of one's driver's license for 5 years, with no occupational license allowed for 2 years. Drunk driving is a threat that we as a society do not have to tolerate. There are solutions, and one of them is reform of drunk driving laws. That reform begins with the House Judiciary Committee. For the sake of Oregonians, I urge this committee to seriously consider all legislation before you today and to treat drunk driving as an epidemic that it has become. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions this time? Thank you for your statement. Yes.
Chairman Myers and members of the House Judiciary Committee, I am Lou Fisk, Vice President of the Lane County Chapter of MED and Director of Court Monitoring. Last Friday, while I was court monitoring and waiting for a verdict from a jury, the defense attorney and I were chit-chatting, and he suggested that we members of MED really should stay up in Salem and not be in the courtrooms because we made him a little bit nervous. So here we are today up in Salem, but we do not go court monitoring to make defense attorneys nervous. We're in the courtrooms to signify that we care about the 70 Americans that are killed by drunk drivers. We care about this epidemic.